IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, welcome everyone to episode 35 of the
Killing It
Podcast. I'm Carl, and we got a full complement of folks here today to ruin your day. So Dave's at home, Ryan's not, I'm at home. So I guess, Ryan, you go first.
You go first. Where interesting are you, Ryan?
Absolutely. I am in Las Vegas, Nevada, right? From, you know, like the 555th time. But it is always fascinating to come here and have conversations with people in person. Very many compliments, by the way, from folks who have been listening. And lots of interest in new folks who said, wait a minute, you guys do this every single week? I got to get in on that conversation. I thought that was a very positive reply.
We've even got mail. We'll be covering a mail issue today.
We have a mailbag. We need a mailbag chime or something like that. Or maybe a Pony Express horse. So since we're always talking about new technology.
We love the feedback, everybody. Thank you. Please write, you know, if you like the show, do share it around. That makes a big difference for us in getting out there. And if you got questions and topics, send them our way. We'd love to hear from you.
And I encourage you to go to killingit.smallbizthoughts.com. We have a form you can fill out there. We get the email and we'll be happy to chat with you. Plus, we're on social media. Like, just look for us. You'll find us.
You will find us. We are not hard to find.
And I think if you find one of us, you'll find all of us.
So. Yes.
We seem to come as a set these days.
Cool. Yes, you can buy the whole set, right?
Collect them all. Collect them, trade them with all your friends. They come in collector's action poses.
So topic one today is a follow-up. So, Dave, you want to set this up since you were the one who thought it was so interesting we should talk about it twice?
Well, clearly. So in those who listened to episode 33, we were talking about AI ethics and the document from the DoD. And as we were closing that conversation, we started talking a little bit around the way ethics would be perceived in different regions. And Carl, you had mentioned that, you know, China might think about ethics as the way they talk about AI and the way they talk about technology as protecting our culture. And Ryan, you said something really interesting. You said, nice. Crossing geographic boundaries is one thing, but crossing cultural boundaries is another. And negotiating a single set of ethics is really hard. And of course, I then, because we were running out of time, said, well, that's a topic for another day. Well, here's the other day. Let's talk a little bit around what cultural boundaries mean to technology and to business and what our thinking is there, as it affects technology implementation and people that are in this space.
Well, I think a reminder that the AR article was from the Department of Defense. So when they talk about China, they don't use the word China. They say totalitarian organizations. China says, well, we don't describe ourselves that way.
Right? Well, true. It's true. And to be fair, the DoD was not calling out China. They were talking about the difference between democratic and authoritarian regimes, right, which is true in more than just one regime. China is an example of that. Right. There are certainly others. But we see this you cannot necessarily assume one standard of cultural norms, even in ones that you could lump together as, you know, democratic style countries. You know, we're all world travelers at some level, and we know that the rules of the game change when you get off the plane in another country.
Well, and a lot of the issues with social media in Europe are around what is culturally acceptable in one country that may not be in another, and that's within Europe. Right? So,
well, the Germans have got some really interesting examples of that, where talking about what happened in World War II, there are specific laws about it, what you can and cannot talk about, promote, and it is intended to make sure, you know, that does not happen again. They've been very clear about that. That is government-imposed regulation, right, around that. And that's just one example of those differences.
See, but and this is the thing, right? So I was in London last week on a client engagement, and you know, we've been told very many times as we travel around the world, well, you know, that's a really interesting idea for you Americans in America, because of course it works that way there, but it's different over here. And I mean, I literally can't count the number of times that folks have said to me, it's different over here. And the answer is, it's absolutely true. It is different. Business is different. Not only the legal construct, but what is appropriate, what is an acceptable approach to a client, what is the role of seniority in decision making, right? These areas are baked in to the cultural point of view. I think what's absolutely critical is, and Dave, you made this comment before, when we were quote unquote negotiating the standards of the internet the first time around, it was an intensely American-centric conversation because that's where the companies that were kind of funding the development process were headquartered. That is absolutely no longer true. It's not just an American conversation. So as we introduce a technology that will not respect boundaries, that will not respect national borders, right? AI will transcend every form of existing organizational structure that we know right now. You have to bring in all of those different points of view. There is a very different point of view based on democratic versus totalitarian. There's also a very different point of view based on emerging economy versus established economy versus like those that are very advanced and open societies versus those that are very like, emerging and closed societies. These are some points of view that you absolutely must take into consideration. And when it comes down to a machine deciding whether or not you get treated well or poorly in a certain situation, I would, for one, really like that machine to have considered where I came from and what my intention was. And I didn't mean to offend anybody. That's just the way that we do things here. And I just legitimately do not know how you actually reconcile all of those things.
What's interesting to me though is so you're exactly right. I've also traveled the world a lot and you get that well, things are different here. But by the way, you get that things are different here across the US too. There are 50, I always describe it, 50 little countries sometimes that make up the United States. The number of times I've been said, that may work where you are from, Dave, but that doesn't work here. That refrain happens pretty commonly. So what I actually think is it's also still an example of cultural differences. They're just happening within this one thing we call America, the US. You have to respect that in the same way that you also respect it in other countries. Now, the differences can get broader based on that. But the other thing about it is that you need to be sensitive no matter where. But I also will want everyone to remember that the world has gotten a lot smaller, a lot faster. Cultural norms have come together because we share a lot of the same pop culture or common communication style because the world is a lot smaller. Our media is oftentimes heavily American dominated, but very much internationally distributed. Oh, and vice versa. You look at, if you're comparing the UK to the US, there's a ton of imported media there too.
And an overlay of this is a couple things. One is the world's getting flatter and flatter. I mean, When the three of us started traveling and crossing borders, you used to have to read a book called, carry a chicken on your lap or do whatever it takes to get the deal, right?
Right.
And now it's all about, okay, well, what are the norms of how you communicate news across borders? And you have to be sophisticated because basically anybody can call anything on the internet a news product. And then it's like, okay, so is Google the news? Is whatever we're putting AI into the news? And is my website somehow going to be, looked at by another country as something that is not quite acceptable? So when we do business internationally, we have to be very, very aware of this. And whether we like it or not, most of us are doing business internationally at some level.
Yeah, but I think you can simplify this a little bit. My father was posted with the embassy in London when I was growing up, and I remember a very clear piece of guidance that 10-year-old Dave was given when we were getting off the plane in London, and that was, Dave, you are a guest in their country. you are to treat it as you are a guest in someone else's home. That you are to be respectful. You can have opinions, but guests are not rude, and they are respectful of their hosts. that advice has served me incredibly well in life. Because because you're sort of laughing at, like, you know, it's another variation of the golden rule. Like, if you're just kind of if you are respectful and interested in people, you can get over a lot of those boundaries.
Yeah, which, and I mean,
take the time to think about it. It matters.
Well, but see, that's the thing, right? To the degree that we intend for emerging technologies to make the world a better place, facilitate commerce, educate, entertain, etc., the populations. If that's what we're intending it to do, I think that you can get close to a set of definitions, right? Maybe one set of boundaries for cultural and entertainment things, one for business, one for government, right? Like increasing levels of precise definitions of the rules that govern AI in from its ethical point of view. But that's a very Pollyanna point of view. For me to suggest that everybody working on AI has good intentions for society would be a very irresponsible thing to suggest.
Right.
They're bad guys who are trying to do bad things with this. And the question is, can you legislate the environment in which those people are trying to do their things? I don't think you can, but I think what you have to do, you have to control what is controllable. And those are these public square conversations where we will either do it for fun or for profit. And there have to be some rules and expectations. And, you know, Dave, to your point, exactly. It is different here. Respect those differences and establish a common ground. And the one thing I have always said is, yes, you are right. Things are different everywhere you go. But the one thing that translates into every single language under the sun, revenue minus cost of goods equals gross margin.
I always do think that the math is the same no matter where you're at.
Math translates.
The takeaway I want people to take away from these conversations really is the start thinking about the impact of the negative versus the upside of the positive. We spend a lot of time thinking about how this is going to go well, what the positive impact is, what the revenue growth is. I think it behooves technologists to start asking a lot harder questions about what's the downside? What happens if this goes wrong? Because I think we can start addressing a lot of this just by asking the question.
Right. And so all the topics today are basically AI plus ethics.
Well, they do tend to go that way.
This whole thing of like what can go right and what can go wrong. Sometimes AI goes sideways on its own, and that's kind of the nature of AI. And our next topic is about this article, super long article we're going to put a link to, but Wall Street Journal talked about how Google interferes with search algorithms and changes your results. And at some level, like, I'm shocked oh, to tell you to find out there's gambling going on in this establishment.
Heaven forbid, I am shocked that they just... Well, possibly did this.
I do declare.
I mean, like, you kind of have to laugh and go, I mean, it took an article to figure this out. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad they did the investigation and I'm glad they're, but come on.
Well, I was actually struck at how many changes there are to the Google algorithm, you know, thousands per year. And, you know, there's so many people that rely on Google. They own 90% of the search. And you guys all have, I'm sure you've looked at your stats for your websites. You know, it's Google, and then it's Google Spain, Google, you know, like every country listed, and then it's somebody else.
I refresh my stats an unhealthy amount of times during the course of the week. I do not mind saying that. So I want to start by making a statement about algorithms that I think is important for everybody to remember. Algorithms are rule sets built by humans to tell the machines what to do. There is not some magic thing that the algorithm is smart on its own and learns. Like, yes, we do teach it, and it can learn on its own as you get into more and more intelligent AI ones. But we, the humans, are the inputs as well as the designers to it. We do have a responsibility to it. But by the way, we also design the thing.
Yep.
From a very basic perspective, the problem Google's trying to solve is they're trying to create search. They have built that to solve the problem. And yes, they keep tweaking it, changing it to make it better. But that also means humans are changing it. We need to be really open about the fact that algorithms are things we build. We are responsible for them as humans. They are not their own thing.
Well, yeah, and there have been some famous, I'd say, hacks of Google that they're addressing. Like, I don't know if you guys remember, a couple of years ago, like literally 2 or 3 years ago, if you put in the question, what happened to the dinosaurs? The first search and the little information box on the right was completely hacked by these right-wing Christians who explained that the dinosaurs died off 10,000 years ago, right? Like the Earth is only 10,000 years old, so here's what happened to the dinosaurs. And you know, everybody saw, like, it became the example of how Google's algorithm is being used by a certain group with pretty low-tech approach by just basically constantly clicking on that, searching, clicking on that, searching, clicking on that, telling everybody all over the world that agrees with them, and they all did it, and there it became the de facto answer to that question.
Right.
Because
right.
So now Google's like, well, you can't do that anymore, right?
Right. The correct answer is not the most clicked necessarily. That is not necessarily the way you determine fact.
Just because it's popular doesn't mean that it's correct. And that might be a word of wisdom to apply to everything in your life. But I see, Dave, I begin with your principle. Every algorithm was written with an intention. What did you intend for that thing to accomplish? And that brought with it your worldview and your expectations for what would be, quote unquote, a good outcome from that algorithm. So if you begin from that logic, I believe that there's some really defendable logic in the Google approach to saying, I will not just let the machine run unabated. I will keep human guardrails around this thing to shape and ensure that we don't get bad responses that are incorrect and misleading, but also so that it's much more difficult, whether it's a social group or whether it's a business, from learning the algorithm for the purpose of manipulating the algorithm. I mean, I remember my very first exposure to optimizing for a Google search environment. I mean, we're talking like the year 2000, right? When that search algorithm was first getting started, and you had to say, okay, well, what are the attributes it's looking for? And then what do we need to artificially manipulate our content in order to be more likely to be more discovered? And we were told by the Google folks, hey, not cool. That is not what we're intending to do here. Please just let the machine work as it's intended. Don't try to manipulate for your own benefit. 20 years later, I still fundamentally buy that logic. I don't blame them for that kind of manipulation. But Dave, like you said, I don't believe for a second that that's the only intention that is being done. As the article pointed out, Carl, my goodness, some of the findings and the way that the algorithm favors large companies and disfavors small companies.
That's the thing I was going to say. It's one thing to say Google's trying their best to be noble and forthright and whatever. They're also overrepresenting large companies, overrepresenting large advertisers, right? When they have negotiations with the people at eBay about what the results will be, they're basically already, just by sitting down to have that meeting, admitting that they're going to give in to eBay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. You know, not good.
No, and again, it's the, like, look, this is the doubt. These are the downsides, you know, we're highlighting this because, you know, there's a techlash coming. There's a backlash coming here societally. And I think it's important that we be addressing it and taking it head on, because this is now the question of the day: is how does this stuff affect us?
Right. And there is a certain ethical piece of it where you say, okay, we're going to let the AI go as far as it wants, but acknowledge that there's a whole bunch of people today that, if you think about like the other countries meddling in our elections, if you can put in sleeper accounts on Facebook by the thousands and then activate them all on one day, you can also do the same thing with the SEO on Google, right? And so how does AI protect from that? It's a serious challenge. And I don't know, I'm I just say I'm glad I'm not on a committee like this at Google. It would be far more stressful than what I do for a living.
Yeah, because to the point that the article was making, and again, so, it's one thing for us to have the opinion that this is happening. It's another thing to validate it with evidence and to put some actual numbers to these things, not just trends and directional things, but 3,200 adjustments to the algorithm in a single year. Okay, I can do math. That's a lot. That's multiple every single day, meaning what the algorithm believed it was trying to accomplish with good intentions yesterday is already different again today. And for any of us to say, well, Google said so, therefore it must be the truth. Well, Google said so when is my question, because if it was 6 months ago, hey, we're a couple of thousand alterations into right. this conversation.
Well, to Dave's point, it's not just Google said it when, but Google said it where. The results are different in Spain than they are in Germany.
Well, and actually, but let's highlight that Google didn't say it oftentimes. It's returning results from another source. And this is an interesting cultural at some level, because sometimes it's Google, but generally, as a general rule, you're being given results from a particular other location.
But Google gives you those results.
True, except that what Google has done, and we're out of time on this topic, but part of what Google's done, if you go to any search on Google, it has an information box there. And because they don't want you to leave their site any more than Yahoo or CNN wants you to leave their site. So you ask for what's the weather in Sacramento, you get an information box. You don't have to leave the site.
That's
you
fair.
Ask, how do I do a translation of currency to another currency? It shows up on the site. Like, they don't want you to leave. So it is Google choosing what's in that box.
That's fair. But there is also a combination of that. You know, is Google getting that information from, are they generating weather information? Are they pulling it from the National Weather Service, from a local weather service, from a private one? I mean, there is a data source at some level. So the line isn't as clear as we would like it to be.
Damn it. No.
I know. If only we could solve this problem in 10 minutes.
Where's my clear lines? So who wants to open the mailbag?
I'll open the mailbag. So our listener, Joe Pannone, wrote in with a really great question for us to tackle, because he'd come across some companies, and as he was thinking about the way to deal with ransomware, and he found some companies that negotiate or pay off the ransomware. So you essentially pay the terrorists on this one. We're going to include a link to a detailed ProPublica story on this in the show notes, because they actually did some research, you know, specifically on this topic earlier this year, diving into some of the companies and their tactics in terms of the way they go to this. So the basic premise is you've been taken over by ransomware, all your data is held hostage. You hire one of these companies that's a ransomware solutions. In many cases, they end up just paying the hackers. They've either negotiated with them, they know how to negotiate it, they get lower rates, they have a relationship with them because they've been forced into this, but because they do this on a regular basis, they know who the various groups are. What's our take? What do we think on paying the ransom?
So part of it is gets back to the ethics question. Do you publicly say nothing, right? So nothing is different than lying, right? Kind of, sort of. But you say nothing publicly, but then you hire this group to go negotiate a lower ransomware, and they obviously are doing this for a profit, right?
Well, and it's situational too, because there is a big difference between, let's go all the way to one extreme, where I'm a home user who double-clicked on something, and now all my photos are encrypted. And that's a different version of that than you are a large multinational
or a
government or agency, and you have now been infected and all of your operations have been shut. They are very different cases.
They are very different cases. And see, my advice has always been, control what you can control and then keep track of everything else. And what I mean by that is, okay, what I can control is setting up solid defenses. What I can control is multi-factor authentication. I can control having a healthy backup and recovery scheme in place, right? Like, these are things that I can do. And then if something beyond my control happens, I have to, again, keep to the set of decisions. What can I actually control? Now, nothing has no ripple effect, right? Every single decision you make has a consequence. If you choose to pay, A, you might get your stuff back because, hey, guess what? Sometimes the criminals who just locked up all your data aren't actually honorable. And when you pay them off, they don't actually give you back your data. Surprise, surprise. But if they do give you back your data, okay, cool. Situation resolved. Well, no, it's not, because now your name was just added to a database of folks who pay, and that brings you back to the top of the list, and everybody else is going to chase you down. But that brings you back to, well, what else could you have done? If it's my photos and I've lost them, lesson learned, you know what? I get to live with those consequences. But if I'm a hospital and literally life-saving patient records are locked up and treatment cannot be delivered to people in need of care, you really have to come back and say, sometimes you just have to pay these guys and deal with the consequences. The consequence, in my opinion, there is not from paying off the ransom. It is from the prior decision to not lock down your systems and implement proper security.
Which sounds easy and is easy at the small end of the space. But when you're talking about a hospital system across many, many states, millions of patients, millions of patient records, and all of their disparate technology that has been glommed together over the last 30 years, it may not be possible to have a BDR system that puts that back in business the next day. And it may be cheaper to pay the ransom. And I got to say, another factor is, I don't know that I want to get involved with the Russian mafia. I will happily hire you to deal with the Russian mafia, and I will be one step back. And I think that's in my stockholders' best interest.
I mean, we would be remiss if we did not show the value that these negotiators are bringing to the table, as they are taking on a certain level of risk in terms of managing that, and they are taking on the risk of then dealing with that element. You know, I think for me, it's one of those cringy decisions where you're just having to make a decision about the value of the data and the risk and what you're willing to take on, and do I like it? Absolutely not. I tend to, you know, I'm on the smaller end of the spectrum, particularly with my own personal stuff, but I also am in the paranoid end of the spectrum, and I have multiple backups, you know, so this is why I have multiple backup systems and all of that kind of stuff. If you are a business, I think it is healthy to have that paranoia, but I think you've got to make that decision. You know, you're going to be making that decision. Do I like it? No. Is it necessarily, this is that ethics gray area where it's not a great answer.
Well, but I mean, remember, this is not the first time we have struggled with this conversation. I am reminded of a certain Denzel Washington movie, right? Man on Fire, a character who was a man of great ethics and principle, and his purpose for existence was to negotiate the return of kidnapping victims, because while we, A, never negotiate with the terrorists, we absolutely positively negotiate with the terrorists in certain situations when life is on the line, right? You know, Hollywood's been dealing with this thing for generations, and believes there are times when it's absolutely the better decision. Take your lumps.
Well, and also, you know, it's very similar to antivirus, right? Forever, our clients have thought, well, you guys probably help create some of these viruses because it, you know, keeps you in business. Well, here's somebody who actually is in business helping people deal with ransomware. And I'm sure they are not creating any ransomware. Don't get me wrong. Please don't send any.
No, we're not implying that. It's just they have identified a hole in the market and they are filling it. Not every hole in the market comes with perfect black or white.
Well, and I gotta say, it's in addition to being risky of dealing with some really nasty people and isolating your clients from them, there's a huge risk in, imagine how much money they are moving in and out of Bitcoin. And, you know, there's the fluctuations in that market. And then there's also just the fact that you've kind of become a bank accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Everybody in tech wants to be a bank.
Well, yeah. And I mean, again, to bring this down to the street level, you individual technology professionals have actually got to start doing something about it. What can you actually do? Well, have a conversation with your clients and point out to them, these negotiators exist. We're not making this up. The ransomware thing is not just the boogeyman. This is a very real phenomenon. And what can you actually control? Well, don't worry about 10 steps down the road of what might happen. Deal with step number one, put in a backup system. Step number two, let's please have multi-factor authentication. Let's do what we can do and use this as an example of control in an uncontrolled.
And part of it's also, I don't know how much these guys deal with the social engineering, right? Because that's the big thing that people are now using to get in. You got AI on one side and social engineering on the other side. So spy versus spy, this game is not going anywhere.
No, and I mean, and Ryan's right. This is the risk reward spectrum. You know, you can go on one end of the risk and protect nothing and just gamble all the time, or you can spend so much money and protect everything and go out of business in that way. You're just gonna find your spot on the line, and this is just one way of balancing it. I don't like it, but I get it. And if push come to shove, and if I had to save my business versus pay a ransomware, I don't think I'm ashamed to admit I'd probably pay it to save my business.
Exactly. So big shout out and thanks to Joe for sending in a question. And if you have a question, please email us, fill out the form. Obviously tell all your friends that they should be listening to the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.